Old Dad and Billy went back to help him. Then they took over the business when he retired.
And now the business belongs to your uncle?
Yes, well, and me, I suppose. Although that's a mixed blessing.
Murray waited.
Trade's not great at the moment.
She shrugged,
careful not to disturb the baby in her arms. Murray made a mental note to return to the detail of who had inherited what from Anna's parents. For now, he wanted to examine the card. He separated the pieces of card from the sections of envelope and laid them out together. He noted the celebratory image on the front of the card, the cruel juxtaposition with the anonymous message inside.
Suicide?
Think again.
Do you have any idea who might have sent this?
Anna shook her head.
How widely known is your address?
I've lived in the same house all my life. Eastbourne's a small place. I'm not hard to find.
She switched the baby expertly from one side to the other.
Murray examined the card again, until he concluded it was safe to look up.
After Dad died, we got a lot of post. Lots of sympathy cards, lots of people remembering cars he'd sold them over the years.
Anna's face hardened.
A few weren't so nice.
In what way?
Someone sent a letter saying Dad would burn in hell for taking his own life. Another one just said, good riddance. All anonymous, of course.
That must have been incredibly upsetting for you and your mother.
Anna shrugged again, but it was unconvincing.
Crackpots. People pissed off because of cars that didn't work out.
She caught the look on Murray's face.
Dad never sold a lemon. Sometimes you get a dud, that's all. People want someone to blame.
Did you keep these letters?
We could compare them to this one, see if it's from someone holding a grudge.
They went straight in the bin.
Mum died 6 months later and...
She looked at Murray, her train of thought abandoned in favour of something more pressing.
I came to see if you'd reopen the investigation into my parents' deaths.
Is there anything else that makes you suspect they were murdered?
What more do you want?
She gestured to the card lying in pieces between them.
Evidence? Murray thought.
He took a sip of his tea to buy himself time. If he passed this to D.I. Robinson now, it would be dismissed by the end of the day. CID were up to their necks in live investigations. It would take more than one anonymous note and a funny feeling to make them reopen a cold case.
Please, Mr. McKenzie, I need to know for certain.
The control that Anna Johnson had shown all the time they'd been talking was starting to crack.
I never believed my parents would kill themselves. They were full of life, full of ambition. They had big plans for the business.
The baby had finished feeding. Anna propped it on her knee, one outstretched hand beneath its chin, the other rubbing circles on its back.
Your mother worked there too?
She did the books and front of house.
Quite the family business.
Murray was heartened to hear there were still a few of them about.
Anna nodded.
When Mum was pregnant with me, she and Dad moved to Eastbourne to be closer to Dad's parents. Granddad wasn't doing too well, and it wasn't long before Dad and Billy were running the show.
Mum, too.
Tired now, the baby's eyes rolled in their sockets, like drunks in the cells on a Saturday night. And when she wasn't working, she was raising money for her animal charity, or out campaigning.
Campaigning for what?
Anna gave a short laugh. Her eyes glistened.
Anything. Amnesty International, women's rights. Even bus services, although I don't think she ever took a bus in her life.
When she got behind something, she made things happen.
She sounds like a wonderful woman, Murray said softly.
There was a story on the news once. Years ago. I was at home with my parents and it was on in the background. Some young lad who'd driven a moped off Beachy Head. They'd recovered the moped, but not his body. And they showed his mum on the television, crying because she couldn't even give him a proper funeral.
The baby strained uncomfortably, and Anna shifted position and patted it on the back.
We talked about it. I remember Mum watching with her hands over her mouth, and Dad being angry with the boy for putting his parents through it.
She tailed off, pausing her rhythmic patting to stare intently at Murray.
They saw what that boy did to his mother, and they would never, ever have done it to me. Tears welled in the corners of Anna's eyes, finding the line of her narrow nose and running in tandem towards her chin. Murray held out his handkerchief, and she took it gratefully, pressing it against her face as though brute force alone could hold back the tears. Murray sat very still. There was much he could have said about the impact of suicide attempts, but he suspected it wouldn't help Anna. He wondered if she'd been offered the right support all those months ago.
You should have been given a leaflet by the officers who dealt with your parents' deaths. There are charities that support people bereaved by suicide. Groups you can go to. People you can see on a one-to-one basis.
Some people found shared experiences a lifeline. They thrived in group therapy sessions, walking out stronger and better equipped to deal with their emotions. A problem shared. But suicide support groups didn't help everyone. They hadn't helped Murray.
I saw a grief counselor.
Did it help?
I had a baby with him.
Anna Johnson gave a half-sob, half-laugh. Murray found himself laughing with her.
Well, that does sound quite helpful.
The tears had slowed. Anna's smile was weak, but steady.
Please, Mr. Mackenzie, my parents didn't commit suicide. They were murdered.
She pointed at the torn-up card.
And this proves it.
It didn't prove it. It didn't prove anything. But it did ask a question, and Murray had never been one to ignore an unanswered question. Perhaps he could take a look himself, pull out the original files, read through the coroner's reports, and when, if, there was something to investigate, he could hand over the package. He had the skills, after all. 30 years in the job, and the best part of that on CID. You didn't hand in your knowledge along with your warrant card. He looked at Anna Johnson, tired and emotional, but determined too. If Murray didn't help her, who would? She wasn't the type to give up.
I'll request the files this afternoon.
Murray had the skills, and he had the time. Lots and lots of time. Chapter 6. You're not allowed to go back. It upsets people. If there was a manual, that would be the first rule. Never go back. Swiftly followed by rule number 2. Never let yourself be seen. You have to move on. But it's hard to move on when you're a non-person. When you've left behind the life you knew and haven't yet begun a fresh one. When you're stuck in no man's land between this life and the next. When you're dead. I followed the rules. I disappeared into this half-life, lonely and bored. I miss my old life. I miss our house, the garden, the kitchen, the coffee machine you bought on a whim. And, vacuous though it sounds, I miss manicures and 6 weekly highlights. I miss my clothes, my beautiful walk-in wardrobe of pressed suits and carefully folded cashmere. I wonder what Anna's done with them all, if she's wearing them. I miss Anna. I miss our daughter. I spent her last year of school filled with dread for her first one at college. I was afraid of the emptiness I knew she'd leave. The influence she'd never know she had on us both. I was afraid of being lonely. Of being alone. People used to say she was the spit of me, and we'd turn to each other and laugh, not seeing it. We were so different. I loved parties, Anna hated them. I loved to shop. My daughter was thrifty, making do and mending. We had the same mousy hair. I never did understand why she wouldn't go blonde. And the same build, with a tendency to plumpness that bothered me more than it did her. I wear my new lightness well, I think, although I confess I mourn the compliments of friends. The journey down takes longer than I anticipated, but my tiredness dissipates the second I set foot on familiar ground. Like a prisoner on parole, I drink in my surroundings, marveling at how so much has changed for me, yet so much has stayed the same. The same trees, still bereft of leaves. A scene so identical to the one I left, it is as though I've only stepped away for a moment. the same busy streets and bad-tempered bus drivers. I catch sight of Ron Dyer, Anna's old head teacher, and shrink back into the shadows. I needn't have bothered. He stares right through me. People see what they want to see, don't they? I walk slowly along quiet streets, reveling in the illicit freedom I've seized for myself. Every action has a consequence. I haven't broken these rules lightly. If I'm caught, I risk losing my next life, languishing instead in purgatory, a prison of my own making. But the buzz of being back is hard to ignore. My senses are tingling after so long away, and as I turn into the next street, I feel a racing in my chest. Nearly home. Home. I catch myself. Remind myself it's Anna's home now. I expect she's made changes. She always loved the bedroom at the back, with the pretty sprigs of blue on the wallpaper. But I suppose it's silly to imagine her there now. She'll have taken over our bedroom. For a second, my defenses slide, and I remember the day we went to see Oak View together. The previous owners, an elderly couple, had updated the electrics and connected the house to mains gas and waste, replacing the costly oil tank and the unpleasant septic tank still buried in the garden. Your father had already made an offer. All that was left for us to do was to breathe life into the place, to uncover the original doors and fireplaces, and free the windows long since painted shut. I slow my pace. Now that I'm here, I'm nervous. I focus on the two things I need to do. Stop Anna going to the police, and ensure that any evidence points to suicide, not murder. But how? A couple, walking arm in arm, turn into the street ahead of me. I step into a doorway, wait until they've passed, and use the time to calm myself. I need to make Anna understand the danger she'll be in if she starts to question what she thinks she knows. How can I do that, yet stay invisible? I imagine a cartoon ghost, rattling chains and wailing in the dead of night. Ridiculous. Impossible. Yet, how else do I get a message to her? I'm here, outside our Anna's house. I retreat to the opposite side of the street, and when even that feels too close, I move into the gated park in the middle of the square, watching through the prickly branches of a holly bush. What if she isn't home? I could hardly have called in advance to check. What if the risks I've taken to come down were all in vain? I could lose everything. Again. A noise along the street makes me retreat further behind the holly. I peer through the gloom onto the street. A woman, walking with a pram. She's on the phone, walking slowly, distracted. I keep watching the house, scanning each window for signs of activity. The pram's wheels make a rhythmic sound on the wet pavement. I remember pushing Anna around the forecourt at Johnson's, in and out of the cars, waiting for sleep to envelop her. We were just kids ourselves, barely scraping by on what your dad saw fit to pay us. The pram was a second-hand monstrosity, with a bouncing chassis that jerked Anna awake if we went over bumps. Nothing like the sleek modern affair this woman has. She pauses by the house, and I tut, impatient for her to move on, in case I miss some movement beyond the open curtains. But she doesn't walk by. And now I see that she isn't alone. She has a dog with her, trotting in the shadows beside her. I feel a sharpness in my chest. Is it? The pram wheels crunch over gravel as she pushes it through the gates and to the front door. The stained glass panel in the front door glows a soft red from the light in the hall. It is. The woman's call ends, and she slips her phone into a pocket. She takes out a key, and as she does so, she pushes back her hood, and I see mousy hair beneath the light above the door, and soft features above a mouth that was always quick to smile, only it isn't smiling now. And there's a pounding in my head, because it is her. It's Anna. And a baby. Our daughter has a baby. She turns around to pull the pram up the steps into the hall, and for a second, she looks out into the park, and it feels as though she's looking right at me. Tears glint on her cheeks. She shivers, pulls the baby into the safety of the hall, and closes the door. Anna has a baby. I have a grandchild. And even though I know no one could have told me that nothing cuts communication channels like a death certificate, I feel a rush of anger that this momentous transition from mother to grandmother has taken place without me knowing. Anna has a baby. This changes everything. It will change Anna. Motherhood will make her question everything she thought she knew. It will make her examine her life, her relationships. My death, yours. Having a baby makes Anna vulnerable. She has something now she loves more than anything else in the world, and when someone knows that, they can use it against you. Don't look for answers, Anna. You won't like what you find. If she goes to the police, she'll put herself and her baby in danger. She'll set something in motion that can't be stopped. Chapter 7 Anna. I've been home for half an hour when the doorbell rings. Laura pulls me into a hug. Mark called me. He didn't want you on your own when you were upset. She gives me another squeeze, then gently pulls away and looks at me, assessing the damage. Guilt seeps through me. I shouldn't have left that message for Mark. There's nothing he could have done, and now he'll be worrying all afternoon, distracted from his course and from the drive home. I'm fine. You don't look it. Can we go inside? It's bloody freezing out here. There's nothing to Laura. She's tiny and skinny, with long blonde hair and a baby face that means she's still asked for ID to buy booze, despite being over 30. I call Rita, who is standing on the driveway, barking at nothing. What's up with her? Invisible squirrels. She's been like this all day. Rita! Reluctantly, the dog comes inside, and I can shut the door. I realize Laura's in jeans, instead of the awful brown and orange uniform of the bank she started at a month ago. Shouldn't you be at work? It didn't pan out. She shrugs off my concern. It's fine, honestly. I wasn't enjoying it. Shall I put the kettle on? When the tea's made, we sit at the island, and I show Laura the photographs of the anonymous card. I took them at the police station, not having thought to do so sooner, and the light reflects off the evidence bags, making the contents hard to read. And that's all it said. Just that one line. Did the police take it seriously? I think so. I catch a look in her eyes. You don't think they should? Of course they should. Look at it. Look at you. It must have been really upsetting. She pauses. Didn't you get something like this when your dad died? That was different. Those people were crazy. She raises an eyebrow. You think this is sane? I look out of the window for the longest while. I think about the searches Dad made on his phone, checking for high tide, for the best place to jump to his death. I think about the chaplain who listened to Mum cry over her husband's suicide. I think about my parents falling 500 feet into ice-cold sea. And I wonder if someone pushed them. I just want answers, Laura. She stares into her tea for a long while before speaking. Sometimes they're not the ones we want. I was 10 when Laura's mum died. I ran to answer the phone, knee-high socks slipping on the hall floor. Can I speak to your mum? Laura! When are you coming to see us again? As mum's goddaughter, Laura was the big sister I never had, 7 years older, and everything I aspired to be, back when I thought it was important. Cool, fashionable, independent. I got Star of the Week today, and... I need your mum, Anna. I'd never heard Laura like that. Serious. Sort of cross, I thought. Although I realized afterwards she'd simply been trying to hold it all together. I took the phone to mum. My mother's crying jags were punctuated with bursts of anger. I heard her rail at my dad when I was in bed, supposedly asleep.
That bloody flat. Damp in every room. Alicia must have told the council about it 100 times. She found mushrooms in the bathroom. Mushrooms! Her asthma was bad at school, but mushrooms, for God's sake. No wonder it got worse.
My dad, soothing, too low to hear.
I mean, they've already said they'll move Laura into a new build. If that's not an admission of guilt, I don't know what is.
Only it wasn't. The housing association strenuously denied any liability. The coroner ruled death by natural causes. Alicia's asthma an unfortunate contributory factor. You still miss her? I ask now. It isn't really a question.
Every day.
Laura meets my eyes.
I want to tell you it gets easier, but it doesn't.
I wonder how I'll feel 16 years from now. Surely this jagged, raw pain in my chest won't still be choking me all that time later. It has to ease. It has to. The nightmares will fade, along with the fresh sense of loss when I walk into a room and realize my father's chair is empty. It will get easier. Won't it? I stand up and crouch beside Ella's bouncy chair. She's sleeping, but I need to distract myself from the surge of emotion. That's the key. Distraction. When Alicia died, Laura had no one. I have Ella, and I have Mark. Mark, who always knows what to say. Always knows how to make me feel better. My parents sent Mark for me. I know that sounds absurd, but I believe people walk into your life at precisely the right moment for you, and Mark is everything I never knew I needed. A few days after Mum died, I drove to Beachy Head. I had refused to go after Dad's death, even though my mother spent hours up there, walking the clifftops, standing at the spot from where he was seen to have jumped. When Mum died as well, I wanted to see what my parents had seen, wanted to try and understand what had gone through their heads. I parked my car and walked to the edge, looked at the sea as it crashed against the rocks. I felt a dizzying rush of vertigo, coupled with a terrifying, irrational urge to jump. I don't believe in an afterlife, but right then, I felt close to my parents for the first time since their deaths, and I wished I knew unequivocally I would be reunited with my loved ones in heaven. If I knew that, I thought, I wouldn't hesitate. The coroner said my mother's suicide was understandable, insofar as any death can be understood. She missed my father. Dad's death sent Mum mad. She became nervous and paranoid, jumping at noises and refusing to answer the phone. I'd go downstairs in the middle of the night for a glass of water and find the house empty, my mother out for a walk in the early hours. I went to see your father. A memorial stone lay in the churchyard, among the other marks of lost lives. I wept to think of her standing alone by his grave. You should have woken me. Wake me next time. She never did. They're vigilant at Beachy Head, particularly on Christmas Eve, less than a week after a copycat suicide has been splashed across the national press. I was still staring at the rocks when the chaplain approached, calm and non-judgmental. I wasn't going to jump, I told him afterwards. I just wanted to know how it must have felt. It wasn't the same chaplain who had spoken to my mother, up there on the clifftop. This man was older, wiser than the young chaplain who had come to the police station 6 days before, shaking in his slip-on loafers as he described my mother's rucksack, heavy with rocks, the way her handbag and mobile phone were placed neatly on the grass, just as my father's wallet and phone had been 7 months previously. That chaplain had been close to tears. She said she changed her mind. He kept his eyes resolutely turned from mine. She let me walk her back to the car. But my mother was a stubborn woman. An hour later, she'd returned to the cliffs, set her bag and phone once again to one side, and, so the coroner ruled, killed herself. The chaplain who spoke to me on Beachy Head last Christmas Eve wasn't taking any chances. He called the police, waiting until they took me gently away,
until he could finish his shift, knowing no one had died on his watch. I was grateful for his intervention. It scared me to realize we were all a single step from the unthinkable. I wasn't going to jump, I told him. But the truth was, I couldn't be sure of that. When I got back home, there was a leaflet stuffed through the letterbox. Psychotherapy services. Smoking cessation. Phobias. Confidence. Divorce mediation. Grief counseling. No doubt the whole street had been leafleted, but it felt like a sign nonetheless. I phoned before I could change my mind. I liked Mark instantly. Felt comforted before he'd even spoken. He is tall without being towering, broad-shouldered without being intimidating. His dark eyes have crow's feet that hint at wisdom, and when he listens, he is thoughtful, interested, taking off his glasses as though it will help him hear better. I couldn't have predicted, that first time, that we'd have ended up together, that we'd have a child together. All I knew was that Mark made me feel safe, and he's made me feel safe ever since. Laura finishes her tea and takes her mug to the sink, where she rinses it and puts it upside down on the draining board. How's Mark taken to being a dad? I straighten. He's obsessed with her. Doesn't even stop to take his coat off when he gets in from work. He goes straight to Ella and takes over. It's just as well men can't breastfeed, or I'd never get a look in. I roll my eyes, but of course I'm not complaining. It's great Mark's so hands-on. You don't know what kind of father someone will be, do you? They say we instinctively search out the characteristics we need in a mate. Honesty, strength, love. But you don't know whether they'll go out at 3 a.m. for the blackcurrant jelly you crave, or do their fair share of the night feeds, and by the time you do, it's too late to back out. I'm lucky to have Mark. Grateful he stuck by us. My father never changed a nappy in his life, and as far as I know, Mum never asked him to. It was just the way things were back then. I imagine Dad looking on as Mark burps Ella, or expertly switches a dirty baby grow for a clean one. And I know he'd have made some quip about new men. I push away the image. If I'm honest, I don't know if Dad would have liked Mark at all. It shouldn't matter. It doesn't matter. Mark's a great dad to Ella, and that's all that counts. I drank too much, that first date. It took the edge off my nerves and went some way to assuaging the guilt I felt at going out and enjoying myself less than 2 months after Mum had died. I'm not normally like this, I said, when we were back at Mark's flat in Putney, and the promised cup of coffee had been abandoned in favour of another glass of wine, the tour of the flat ending abruptly in the bedroom. It sounded like a line, but it wasn't. I'd never slept with anyone on a first date, or a second or a third. But that night, I felt impetuous. Life was too short not to grab it by the horns. In reality, I was drunk, not empowered. Reckless, not spontaneous. Mark, perhaps a little less drunk, perhaps still conscious of the fine ethical line we were crossing, attempted to slow things down, but I wouldn't be swayed. The guilt came the following morning. A burning shame that tore through my self-respect and pushed me out of Mark's bed before he woke. He found me by the front door, putting on my boots. You're leaving? I thought we could go out for breakfast. I hesitated. He didn't look like a man who'd lost all respect for me, but memories of the night before made me wince. I had a sudden recollection of peeling off my knickers in a low-grade striptease that ended when I lost my balance and toppled onto the bed. I have to go. I know a great place around the corner. It's early still. The unspoken question, where did I have to be so urgently at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning, made me say yes. By 9, my hangover had abated, along with my awkwardness. If Mark wasn't embarrassed, why should I be? We agreed on one thing, though. It had happened a little faster than either of us had expected. "Shall we start again?" Mark suggested. "Last night was fantastic, but maybe we could have another first date. Get to know each other." It was another 5 weeks before we went to bed again. I didn't know it then, but I was already pregnant.
Should I take it to the papers? I ask Laura now. You might be jumping ahead a bit.
She winces at her poor turn of phrase.
Sorry.
They wrote an article when Mum died. They might do a follow-up, appeal for information. I picture the card. Suicide. Think again. No one came forward at the time, but if Mum was with someone that day, someone who pushed her off the cliff, they must have come across other people.
Anna, the chaplain saw your Mum.
I fall silent. He talked her back from the edge. She said she wanted to kill herself. I want to put my fingers in my ears. La, 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 la. He wasn't there when she actually went over, though, was he? He didn't see if she was alone when she came back. There's a pause before Laura speaks. So, Caroline's on Beachy Head. She's ready to jump. The chaplain talks her down. Then, an hour later, someone murders her. She doesn't have to point out how absurd it sounds.
She could have been trying to get away from someone. Thought that killing herself was better than being killed. Only she couldn't go through with it. And when the chaplain thought he was taking her to safety, he was actually delivering her to...
I tail off, the pity in Laura's eyes too much to take.
To who?
Ella's awake. She's making tiny mewing sounds and pushing her bunched fist into her mouth. Who killed her, Anna? Who would have wanted Caroline dead? I chew my bottom lip.
I don't know. One of those idiots who blame everyone else when their car breaks down?
Like the idiots who sent the anonymous letters after your dad died.
Exactly.
I'm triumphant, thinking she's proved my point. Then I see her face and somehow it's me who's proved hers. The mews become full-blown wails. I take Ella from her bouncy chair and start to feed her.
Look at you. Quite the pro now.
Laura smiles. In the early days, I could only breastfeed in one particular chair, with a precise arrangement of cushions around me, and no one else in the room to distract Ella from latching on. Nowadays, I feed one-handed, standing up if I need to. I don't let Laura change the subject. Her question is an important one. Who would have wanted Mum dead? Some of the car dealers my parents and Billy crossed paths with made no attempts to hide their shady practices. Could Mum and Dad's deaths have been the result of a bad business deal?
Will you help me go through Mum and Dad's study?
Now?
Is it a problem? Do you need to go?
If Laura can't help, I'll do it on my own. I'm wondering if Mum's campaigning is the key. When I was in my teens, she got involved in protests against animal testing at the University of Brighton, earning herself a smattering of hate mail from employees and their families as a result. I don't recall her campaigning against anything more contentious than planning applications and cycle lanes in recent years, but maybe I'll find something in the study that suggests otherwise.
I don't mean that. I just meant... Are you sure you want to do it now?
Laura, you've spent the best part of a year nagging me to do it.
Only because it's ludicrous to have been working at the kitchen table when you could have been using that lovely study.
And I wasn't nagging. Although I do think it would have been cathartic, whatever Mark said. I keep my response light. He does do this sort of thing for a living, you know.
What's healthy about shutting everything away and pretending it isn't there?
He didn't tell me to pretend it wasn't there, just that I should deal with it when I felt ready.
When he said you were ready.
No, when I felt ready. Firmer now. I know Laura's loyalties, like Uncle Billy's, lie with me, first and foremost, but I wish they were less protective. It was too fast. That was the problem. Mark and I haven't even been together a year, and our baby is 8 weeks old. We're still finding out each other's favorite foods, movies, books. I've only met his mother twice. We're like teenagers, caught out the first time they have sex, except that I'm 26 and Mark's 40.
That's part of it, too. He's old enough to be your father, Billy said, when I'd got all the announcements over in one go.
I've met someone,
He's moving in with me. Oh, and by the way, our baby's due in October.
Barely. And Dad was 10 years older than Mum.
And look how that turned out.
What's that supposed to mean?
But he wouldn't be drawn, and I was secretly glad. I didn't want to know. I'd never wanted to know. When you're young, you think your parents are perfect. Perhaps they shout at you a bit too often, or withhold pocket money till your room's been tidied. But they're your parents. They love you. You love them. I was at university when I realized not everyone's parents were like mine. That not everyone's mum and dad had screaming rows. Not everyone's mum and dad took daily trips to the bottle bank. The insight was enough. I didn't want more. I didn't want to know how my parents' marriage worked. If it worked at all. It wasn't my concern.
Like the other ground floor rooms, the windows in the study are full height, with painted shutters so rarely used they now don't close. A partner's desk in the center of the room meant my parents could work at the same time, although the only time they did so was when they were doing the VAT return, the stress of which invariably caused a row.
"Anna, ask your father to pass me the stapler," Mum said one Saturday, when I'd pushed open the door to the study to see if they'd be much longer. I handed her the stapler myself and went out on my bike until it was all over. Mostly, my parents would take it in turns to stay late at the showroom until I was old enough to join them at work after school or to come home on my own. My hand on the doorknob, I take a deep breath. I don't use this room. I don't go in there. I pretend it doesn't exist.
"You don't have to do this. All the important papers have been gone through."
It's a generously oblique reference to the long day Laura spent, patiently weeding out paperwork from the rest of my parents' belongings, to then spend another day on the phone on my behalf, changing the name on utility bills and cancelling dozens of subscriptions in my parents' names. My gratitude had been tinged with guilt. Who did this for Laura when Alicia died? I pictured a 17-year-old Laura in her newly acquired modern council house, sorting through her mother's paperwork, and my heart broke.
"It's time," I say. I want to know everything about my parents' lives. Everything I turned a blind eye to. Everything I hoped wasn't true. I need to know it all. Who were my parents' friends? Who were their enemies? Who killed them?
Chapter 8. Murray. The archivist, Dennis Thompson, had been bordering on the large side when he and Murray had been on shift together. Now, Dennis was as wide as he was tall, with a shiny pate and two sets of glasses perched above his eyebrows.
"Can't get on with varifocals."
He retrieved the reading pair and popped them on the bridge of his nose, then peered at the lids of the two files he had found for Murray.
"Tom Johnson, Caroline Johnson."
The fact that the anonymous card had been delivered on the anniversary of Caroline Johnson's death suggested that was where suspicion lay, but since her death had been so inextricably linked with her husband's, Murray intended to start at the beginning.
"Those are the ones. Thanks."
Dennis pushed an A4 book across the counter. On each page were neat columns recording signatures against every file removed from the archive, along with the date it was returned. Murray picked up the pen, then hesitated. He looked at his old crewmate.
"I don't suppose..."
"On the QT?"
"Please. I'll get them back before you know it."
Sometimes, Murray concluded, as he left the archive room with the files, there were advantages to having been around as long as he had. He wanted to look through the case file again on the bus home, but there were two response officers, their ties and epaulettes hidden beneath North Face fleeces, sitting directly behind him. They hadn't noticed him. It was funny how invisible you became once you'd retired. But Murray wasn't about to advertise his presence with illicitly obtained police files. Instead, he looked out of the window and wondered what Sarah would think about the Johnson case. For most of his career, Murray had taken his work home. In the early years of their marriage, Sarah had struggled through a number of low-paid jobs. Each had required levels of punctuality, politeness, and positivity that had proved impossible for Sarah to sustain, and each had triggered long periods of depression when they had ended prematurely. Eventually, Sarah had given in to what Murray had suggested from the start, that she stay home and he bring home the bacon. It had been a relief for them both. Murray had begun sharing snippets of his day with Sarah. He had been conscious of the confidentiality boundaries within which he worked, but he was mindful, too, that on days when Sarah felt unable to leave the house, this insight into the wider world was as important to her as it was interesting. To his surprise, he grew to rely on these exchanges as much as Sarah did, reaping the benefits of a fresh perspective, untarnished by police prejudice. He looked forward to telling her about Tom and Caroline Johnson. The bus stopped at the end of Murray Street, a cul-de-sac of chalet bungalows built in the 60s and occupied by a mix of first-timers, families, and pensioners. Several of the bungalows had been extended so much they were now rather grand two-story detached houses, their back gardens decked for summer barbecues. With the exception of new carpets and a lick of paint every few years, Murray's house looked exactly the way it had looked when he and Sarah bought it in 1984, the year he finished his probationary period and was confirmed as a police officer. Murray didn't get off the bus. Instead, he stayed on for another 5 stops, thanking the driver and walking the short distance to Highfield. Once a rather grand country home, the Grade 2 listed building was built in 1811 and had been used by the NHS since the early 50s. Surrounded by lovely gardens, the historic effect was marred somewhat by the surrounding porter cabins and cheap, flat-roofed buildings installed to house the growing department that was needed to support its patients. Patients like Sarah. Murray was familiar with most parts of Highfield. There was a well-attended drop-in centre, with craft activities, a patient-run cafe, and a peer support group. There were outpatient clinics, counselling services, and cookery classes for patients with eating disorders. There were wards for patients with various mental health problems, requiring varying levels of support, including a high-security ward, on which Sarah had spent 10 days in 2007, and which Murray could no longer pass without remembering the awful day he had pleaded with the doctors to section his wife. Sarah had been upfront about her diagnosis the first time she and Murray had met, at the buffet lunch laid on after Murray's passing out parade. Her older brother Carl had been part of the same intake, and although the two men hadn't been friends, Murray had been drawn to the vivacious girl standing with Carl's family. He'd wondered if she was Carl's girlfriend, had been relieved to discover she wasn't. "You know I'm mental, right?" Sarah had thrown it down like a challenge. She'd been wearing enormous silver-hooped earrings that swung when she laughed, and a luminous pink batwing jumper that hurt his eyes. Murray hadn't laughed, partly because political correctness had been part of his makeup long before it had become part of police vocabulary, but mainly because he couldn't reconcile the term with the woman opposite him. She had so much energy she couldn't stay still, and her eyes sparkled as though they saw joy in everything. There was nothing mental about Sarah. "Borderline personality disorder." She'd smiled that big smile again. "It sounds worse than it is, I promise." BPD. Those 3 letters had bookended their relationship ever since. Murray had swiftly realized the sparkle appeared only on Sarah's better days, and that between times, the pain and fear in those slate-grey eyes would be unbearable. Currently, Sarah was a voluntary patient on a ward where Murray knew everyone by name. Visiting hours were restricted, but staff were understanding about Murray's shift patterns, and he signed his name in the book and waited in the family room while someone fetched Sarah. Family rooms were different in every hospital and clinic. Sometimes you'd feel you were in a prison visiting center, with stark walls and a uniformed member of staff watching over you. In other places, they were more relaxed, with sofas and a TV, and staff dressed so casually, you'd have to check for a name badge to make sure they weren't patients. The family room at Highfield fell somewhere in between. It was divided into 2 sections. In the first, an arts and craft table boasted coloured paper and pots of felt-tip pens. Fiddly, sticky pads were provided for children and their parents to embellish their homemade cards, without the safety risks presented by stolen rolls of sellotape. The scissors were plastic-coated with rounded ends. In the second part of the room, where Murray took a seat, were sofas and low coffee tables scattered with magazines several months out of date. Sarah put her arms around him and hugged him hard.
How are you feeling?
Sarah wrinkled her nose.
There's a new girl in the room next to me who bangs her head against the wall when she's stressed.
She paused.
She's stressed a lot.
Hard to sleep?
Sarah nodded.
Be quieter at home. Murray saw the flicker of anxiety across Sarah's face. He didn't push it. It had been 3 weeks since Sarah had cut herself so badly she'd needed stitches in both wrists. A cry for help, the A&E sister had said, when it was discovered that Sarah had already called an ambulance, a bag in the hall containing the few things she'd need at Highfield.
I could feel it happening again, she'd said to Murray, when he'd broken every speed limit to get to the hospital.
It. An indefinable, overwhelming presence in their lives. It stopped Sarah going out. It meant she found it hard to make friends, and even harder to keep them. It lay beneath the surface of Murray's and Sarah's lives. Always there. Always waiting.
Why didn't you phone Mr. Chowdhury? Murray had said.
He wouldn't admit me. Murray had held her, trying to empathize, but finding it impossible to relate to a logic that saw self-harming as the only route into a place of safety.
I had an interesting day, he said now.
Sarah's eyes lit up. She sat on the sofa cross-legged, with her back against the arm. Murray had never seen his wife sit properly on a sofa. She would lie on the floor, or sprawl with her head dangling off the edge of the seat, and her legs stretched up so her toes touched the wall. Today Sarah was wearing a long grey linen dress, teamed with a bright orange hoodie, with sleeves that she'd pulled over her hands so often they now stayed there of their own accord.
A woman came in to report that her parents' suicides were, in fact, murders.
Do you believe her? As usual, Sarah cut straight to the chase. Murray hesitated.
Did he? I honestly don't know.
He told Sarah about Tom and Caroline Johnson, about their rucksacks filled with rocks, the witness reports, the chaplain's intervention. Finally, he told her about the anonymous anniversary card, and Anna Johnson's insistence that he reopen the investigations into her parents' deaths. Were either of the parents suicidal?
Not according to Anna Johnson.
Caroline Johnson had no history of depression prior to her husband's death, and his suicide had come completely out of the blue.
Interesting.
There was a spark in Sarah's eyes, and Murray felt warmth spread through him. When Sarah was unwell, her world shrank. She lost interest in anything outside of her own life, displaying a selfishness that was far removed from the woman she really was. Her interest in the Johnson job was a good sign. A great sign. And Murray was doubly glad he had decided to take a look at the case. It hadn't troubled him that the subject matter might have been insensitive for a woman with a long history of self-harm. He had never tiptoed around Sarah in the way that so many of their friends had done. They had been having coffee with a colleague of Murray's one time, when a discussion had begun on Radio 4 about suicide rates among young people. Alan had lunged across his kitchen to turn off the radio, leaving Murray and Sarah exchanging amused glances.
I'm ill, Sarah said gently, when Alan had taken his seat again and the kitchen was quiet.
It doesn't mean we can't talk about mental health issues, or suicide. Alan had looked to Murray for reassurance, and Murray had staunchly refused to make eye contact. Nothing was more likely to upset the tightrope on which Sarah lived than thinking she was being judged, talked about.
If anything, it makes me more interested than your average layperson, Sarah had continued.
And frankly, she had given Alan a wicked grin, if anyone's an expert on suicide around here, it's me. People liked boxes, Murray had concluded. You were ill or you were well, mad or sane. Sarah's problem was that she climbed in and out of a box, and people didn't know how to deal with that.
Have you got the files with you? Sarah looked around for his briefcase.
I haven't looked at them myself yet.
Bring them tomorrow.
Sure.
He looked at his watch.
I'd better go. Hope you get a bit more sleep tonight.
She walked him to the door and hugged him goodbye, and Murray kept a smile on his face until he was safely out of sight. Sometimes it was easier to leave Sarah at Highfields when she was having a bad day, easier to go home when she was curled up in a ball on her bed, because he knew she was in the best possible place, that she'd be safe, looked after. But when Sarah was calm, happy even, every step away felt like a step in the wrong direction. How could Highfield, with its clinical smell and cell-like bedrooms, be better than their comfortable, cozy bungalow? How could Sarah feel safer in hospital than at home? Later, when he'd cleared away his plate and washed the pan he'd used for his omelette, Murray sat at the table and opened the Johnson's files. He read through the call logs, the witness statements, and the police reports. He looked at photographs of exhibits, of Tom Johnson's abandoned wallet and his wife's handbag, and read the text messages sent by each of them prior to their deaths. He scrutinized the summing up from each inquest and the coroner's verdict of suicide. Murray laid everything out on the kitchen table, along with the evidence bag containing the anonymous card sent to Anna Johnson, which he placed in the middle, between her parents' files. After reading through the coroner's reports one more time, he put them at the back of the table and snapped open a brand new notebook, as symbolic as it was practical. If Anna's mother had been murdered, Murray needed to approach this investigation as though it were fresh out of the box, and that meant starting from the beginning, with Tom Johnson's suicide. Murray had become a detective in 1989, when files had still been written longhand, and cracking a crime had meant legwork, not cyber sleuthing. By 2012, when Murray had retired, the job had changed beyond all recognition, and among the feelings of loss as he handed in his warrant card was a barely acknowledged streak of relief. He had found it increasingly hard to get to grips with technology, and still preferred to write his statements with the engraved fountain pen that had been Sarah's present to him when he had won a place on CID. For a second, Murray felt his confidence waver. Who did he think he was? That he'd find something in these files that hadn't been seen before? He was 60, retired from the force, and now working as a civilian. He'd spent the last 5 years checking driving licenses and taking reports of lost property. He fiddled with the fountain pen in his hand, ran his finger over the writing. D.C. Mackenzie. Pulling his sleeve over his hand, he buffed the silver until it shone. He wished Sarah were there. "Remember that post office robbery," he imagined her saying. There were no leads, no forensics, no one had a clue. No one except you. They'd been close to filing the job, but Murray hadn't let it lie. He'd hit the streets, knocking on doors, shaking up the community. He'd tapped up his network of informants, and gradually, a name had emerged. The lad had gone down for 14 years. "That was a long time ago," a voice whispered in his head. Murray shook it away. He gripped his pen. The job might have changed, but criminals hadn't. Murray had been a good detective. One of the best. That hadn't changed. Chapter 9. Anna and Laura are picking through the life we left behind. "I don't like it. I want to intervene. To stop them opening drawers and holding up notebooks and books and boxes of photographs. The aftermath of a death is an unwanted gift to our loved ones. It is our children, our spouses, our friends, who must tie up the loose ends and clear away the remnants of a sudden departure. I did it for my parents, at their house in Essex. You did the same for yours, here in Eastbourne. Now, Anna's doing it for me. For the two of us." I watched Laura pick up a ceramic pot that once held a succulent, dried earth clinging to the inside, and discard it. Two distinct piles are emerging on either side of the desk, and I wonder who is driving this efficiency. Anna, or Laura? Did she make Anna sort through our belongings today? Is Laura pushing her unwittingly towards danger? They're talking, too distant for me to make out the words. My glimpse into this scene is narrow, obscured. It frustrates me, because unless I know what's happening now, how can I influence what happens next? Our granddaughter lies on a padded mat, beneath an arch from which hang brightly colored animals. She kicks her legs, and Anna smiles at her, and my breath catches for a second as I imagine being a mother who could walk through the door as though she'd never been away. A mother who hadn't missed a year of one life, the birth of a whole new one. There are no decorations up, no twinkling lights on the banister or wreath on the door. It is 4 days until Christmas, and I wonder if they are waiting until Christmas Eve, forming new traditions as a family, or whether the absence of festive cheer is intentional, whether Anna can't face the sight of tinsel and tawdry baubles. Laura is looking through my diary. I see Anna glance at her, bite her bottom lip as if to stop herself from commenting. I know what she's thinking. We'd been at Oakview for a year when the burglary happened. They didn't take a lot. There wasn't a lot to take. But they rifled through the whole house, leaving destruction in their wake. A messy search, the police called it. It was weeks before the house was back to normal, and months before I felt at ease again. There was nothing secret about our lives, not back then. But still, I felt angry that someone knew so much about me, when I knew nothing about them. That same feeling of anger returns as I watch Laura flick through the pages of my appointment diary. There's nothing of consequence in there, but the intrusion is unbearable. Stop it, I want to shout. Stop looking through my things. Get out of my house. Only it isn't my house anymore. It's Anna's. And she laughs at something Laura says, and smiles a sad smile when Laura points something out that I'm not permitted to see. I am excluded. But Anna's laugh is short. Polite. Her smile doesn't reach her eyes. She doesn't want to be doing this. Laura looks like her mother. I was at school with Alicia. The only person she told when, a week before her 16th birthday, she discovered she was pregnant. Skinny as a rake, she was showing before she was 8 weeks gone, and out on her ear not long after, when the baggy jumpers she'd adopted did nothing to fool her mum. When I left school 2 years later, my PA job just about covering an apartment with a lift and communal laundry, with enough left over for weekend chips and wine, Alicia was living on benefits in a high-rise in Battersea. I took them on holiday. We spent 3 nights in a B&B in Derbyshire, sharing a double bed, with Laura in between. "We should get a place together," Alicia said on the last day. "We'd have the best time." How could I tell her that wasn't what I wanted from my life? That I'd been careful not to fall pregnant, that I loved my single life and my friends and my job. How could I tell her that I didn't want to live in a damp flat and that, however much I liked spending time with her and Laura, I didn't want to live with someone else's baby? "The best," I agreed, and then I changed the subject. I should have helped more. Anna kneels on the carpet and pulls open the bottom drawer of the desk. It comes out with more force than she expects, and she falls back, the drawer on her lap. I see Laura look up to check she's okay, watch Anna laugh at her own clumsiness. Laura goes back to the pile of my diaries, and Anna lifts the drawer to slot it back into the desk, but something stops her. She's seen something. Anna sets the drawer to one side and reaches a hand into the base of the pedestal. I see her glance at Laura to check she isn't watching, and as Anna's eyes widen, I know, as clearly as if I could see it, that her hand has closed around the smooth glass of a vodka bottle. There's disappointment on her face. I know that feeling, too. She pulls out her hand, empty, pushes the drawer back into the desk, and leaves the bottle in its hiding place. She says nothing to Laura, and the feeling of exclusion disappears, thanks to this small complicity Anna isn't even aware of. Some secrets shouldn't be shared outside the family. Others shouldn't be shared at all. Chapter 10